Disc 7.
Chapter 23. Le Rouret, Provence. Gabriel eased away from Antonella Huber's villa through the gathering darkness, accompanied by the savage barking of the Belgian shepherds. Chiara sat next to him, clutching the letter. At the bottom of the hill he turned onto a two-lane highway and headed west toward Grasse. The day's last light lay on the ridgeline of the distant hills like a scarlet wound. 5 minutes later, he noticed the dark grey Fiat sedan. The man behind the wheel was too careful. He stayed in his own lane at all times, and even when Gabriel allowed his speed to dip well below the limit, the Fiat remained several car lengths off his rear bumper. No, thought Gabriel, this is not your average suicidal Frenchman behind the wheel. He followed the highway into Grasse, then turned down the hill into the old town center. It had been taken over long ago by Middle Eastern immigrants, and for a moment Gabriel might have imagined he was in Algiers or Marrakesh. Put away the letter. What's wrong? We're being followed. Gabriel made a series of quick turns and accelerations. Is he still there? Still there. What do we do? Take him for a ride. Gabriel left the old town and made his way back up the hill to the main highway, the Fiat following closely behind. He sped through the center of town, then turned onto the N85, a highway that runs from Grasse high into the Maritime Alps. 10 seconds later, the Fiat swerved into his rear-view mirror. Gabriel pressed the accelerator to the floor and pushed the Peugeot hard up the steep grade. Grasse gradually fell away. The road was winding, full of switchbacks and hairpin turns. To their right rose the scrub-covered slope of the mountain. To their left, a deep gorge, falling away toward the sea. The Peugeot had less power than Gabriel would have liked, and no matter how hard he pushed it, the Fiat sedan easily kept pace. Whenever a straight section of road stretched before him, he would lift his eyes into the rearview mirror and check on the Fiat. Always there, a few car lengths back. Once he thought he could see the driver talking on a mobile phone. Who do you work for? Who are you calling? And how in the hell did you find us? Antonella Huber. They'd killed her mother. They probably had a man watching the villa. 10 minutes later, the village of Saint-Vallier appeared before them, quiet and tightly shuttered. Gabriel pulled over in the center of town, next to a small square, and traded places with Chiara. The Fiat parked on the opposite side of the square and waited. Gabriel told Chiara to take the D5 toward Saint-César. Then he took out the Beretta 9mm he'd been given by Shimon Pasner in Rome. The Fiat followed after them. It was a long descent, winding and difficult in some sections, straight and fast in others. Chiara drove the same way she'd handled the motor yacht, with skill and a certain easy confidence that Gabriel couldn't help but find attractive. Did you take the defensive driving classes at the academy? Of course. Did you learn anything? Number one in my group? Show me. She downshifted and slammed the accelerator to the floor. The Peugeot shot forward, engine screaming. She stayed in that gear, foot to the floor, until the needle topped the red zone, then power shifted. Gabriel looked over at the speedometer and saw it inching toward 180 kilometers per hour. Her rapid acceleration seemed to catch the driver of the Fiat by surprise, but he recovered quickly, and soon was sitting in his usual place 20 meters off their rear bumper. Our friend is back. What do you want me to do? Make him work. I want his nerves on edge. During a long downhill straightaway, Chiara pushed the Peugeot above 200. Then she entered a winding section, expertly downshifting and braking in and out of the turns. Obviously, she had learned her lessons well at the academy. The man in the Fiat was having trouble keeping pace. Twice, he nearly lost control in the turns. At the rate of speed they were traveling, it did not take long to reach Saint-César. It was a medieval town, walled in places and split in half by the D5. Chiara slowed. Gabriel shouted at her to go faster.
What if someone crosses the fucking road?
I don't care. Go faster, damn it.
Gabriel?
They flashed through the darkened town in a blur. The driver of the Fiat did not have the courage to follow their lead, and slowed as he passed through the town. As a result, he emerged, trailing them by some 300 meters.
That was fucking insane! We could have killed someone!
Don't let him get any closer. The road became a four-lane highway. On their left was a large nature area, famous for its caves and grottos, and in the distance was a ridge of stark mountains visible in the bright moonlight.
"Turn there!"
Kiara slammed on the brakes, throwing the Peugeot into a power slide. Then she simultaneously downshifted and hit the accelerator, sending them careening along a dirt track. Gabriel turned around and took another long look over his shoulder. The Fiat had made the turn and was racing after them.
"Kill the lights."
"I won't be able to see."
"Kill them now."
She switched off the lights and instinctively eased off the gas, but Gabriel shouted at her to go faster, and soon they were plunging through the luminous glow of the moonlight. They entered a grove of scrub oak and umbrella pine. The track hooked sharply to the right. The headlights of the Fiat were nowhere to be seen.
"Stop."
"Here?"
"Stop!"
She slammed on the brakes. Gabriel threw open the door. The air was filled with a choking dust.
"Keep going,"
he said, then leapt out and slammed the door shut. Kiara did as she was told, continuing in the direction of the mountain ridge. A few seconds later, Gabriel could hear the Fiat speeding toward his position. He stepped off the track and knelt behind an oak, the Beretta in his outstretched hands. As the Fiat came hurtling around the corner, Gabriel fired several shots into the tires. At least two exploded. The Fiat instantly lost control, bucking and fishtailing, before the centrifugal force of the turn threw it into a violent leftward roll. Gabriel lost count of how many times the car flipped over. A half dozen at least, perhaps more. He rose to his feet and slowly walked towards the crumpled mass of steel, the Beretta at his side. Somewhere, a mobile phone was ringing. He found the Fiat, wheels up, resting on its smashed roof. Bending down, he peered through a shattered window and saw the driver, lying on what was once the ceiling. His legs were twisted grotesquely, his chest crushed and bleeding severely. Still, he was conscious, and his hand seemed to be reaching for a gun lying a few inches beyond his fingertips. The eyes were focused, but the hand would not obey the commands of his brain. His neck was snapped, and he didn't realize it. Finally, his eyes left the gun and settled on Gabriel.
"You were a fool to chase us like that," Gabriel said softly. "You're an amateur. Your boss sent you on a suicide mission."
"Who's your boss?"
"He's the man who did this to you."
"Not me."
The man managed little more than a gurgle. He was looking at Gabriel, but his gaze was somewhere else. He did not have long to live.
"You're not hurt too badly,"
Gabriel said gently.
"Some cuts and scrapes. Maybe a broken bone or two. Tell me who you're working for so I can call an ambulance."
The man's lips parted, and he emitted a sound. Gabriel leaned close so he could hear.
Casagrande?
Carlo Casagrande? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Gabriel reached inside the dying man's jacket and gently patted around until he found a wallet. It was soaked with blood. As he dropped it into his pocket, he could hear the telephone ringing again. It had ended up somewhere in the back seat by the sound of it. He peered through the opening where the rear window had once been and saw the phone, power light aglow, lying on the ground beneath the trunk. He stretched out his hand and took hold of it. Then he pressed the send button and brought it to his ear.
"Pronto."
"What's going on up there? Where is he?"
"He's right here,"
Gabriel said calmly in Italian.
"In fact, he's speaking with you right now."
Silence.
"I know what happened in that convent," Gabriel said. "I know about Crux Vera. I know that you killed my friend. Now, I'm coming for you."
"Where's my man?"
"He's not doing so well at the moment. Would you like a word with him?"
Gabriel placed the telephone on the ground a few inches from the dying man's mouth. As he stood up, he could see the lights of the Peugeot bouncing toward him along the track. Kiara braked to a halt a few yards from where he was standing. Walking back to the car, Gabriel could hear only one sound. Chapter 24. Saint César, Provence. Gabriel searched the dead man's wallet by the jade-colored glow of the dashboard lights. He found no driver's license and no formal identification of any kind. Finally, He discovered a business card, folded in half and tucked behind a photograph of a girl in a sleeveless dress. It was so old, he had to switch on the overhead light in order to make out the faded name. Paolo Olivero, Ufficio Sicurezza di Vaticano. He held it aloft for Chiara to see. She glanced at it, then returned her eyes to the road.
What does it say?
That there's a high probability the man I just killed was a Vatican cop.
Great.
Gabriel memorized the telephone number on the card, then tore it to shreds and flicked it out the window. They came to the Autoroute. When Chiara slowed for guidance, Gabriel directed her west, toward Aix-en-Provence. She lit a cigarette with the dashboard lighter. Her hand was shaking.
Would you like to tell me where we're going next?
Out of Provence, as quickly as possible, he said. After that, I haven't decided.
Am I allowed to offer an opinion?
I don't see why not.
It's time to go home. You know what happened at the convent, and you know who killed Benjamin. There's nothing else you can do but dig yourself deeper into a hole.
There's more, Gabriel said. There has to be more.
What are you talking about?
He stared absently out his window. The landscape was stark and windswept, red dust in the air. He saw none of it. Instead, he saw Sister Vincenza, sitting on the very spot where Martin Luther and Bishop Lorenzi had sealed their contract of murder, telling him that Benjamin had come to the convent of the Sacred Heart to hear about the Jews that had taken refuge there. He saw Alessio Rossi, stinking of fear, fingernails gnawed to the quick, telling him how Carlo Casagrande had forced him to abort his investigation of missing priests. He saw Sister Regina Carcassi listening to Luther and Lorenzi calmly discuss why Pope Pius XII should remain silent in the face of genocide, while a child slept with his head in her lap, a rosary wrapped around his hand. And finally he saw Benjamin, a boy of 20, myopic and round-shouldered, brilliant and destined for academic greatness. He had wanted to be a part of the Wrath of God team as badly as Gabriel had wanted to be released from it. Indeed, Benjamin had wanted to be an Aleph, an assassin, but his methodical brain did not leave him with the skills necessary to point a Beretta at a man's face in a darkened alley and pull the trigger. It did give him all the tools necessary to be a brilliant support agent, and never once did he make an error. Even at the end, when Black September and the European security services were breathing down their necks. This was the Benjamin Gabriel saw now, the Benjamin who would never stake his reputation on the word of a single source or document, no matter how compelling. Benjamin wouldn't have written a book implicating the Catholic Church in the Holocaust based only on Sister Regina's letter. He must have had something else. Chiara swung to the side of the autoroute and applied the brakes.
So?
I worked with Benjamin in the field. I know how he thought, how his mind worked. He was careful to a fault. He had backup plans for his backup plans. Benjamin knew the book would be explosive. That's why he kept the contents so secret. He would have hidden copies of his important material in places his enemies wouldn't think to look.
Gabriel hesitated, then added, "But places his friends would think to look." Chiara stuffed her cigarette into the ashtray.
When I was at the academy, we were taught how to walk into a room and find 100 places to conceal something, documents, weapons, anything at all.
Benjamin and I did the course together.
So where are we going?
Gabriel lifted his hand and pointed straight ahead. They drove in shifts, roughly 2 hours on, 2 hours off. Chiara managed to sleep during her rest periods, but Gabriel lay awake, the seat reclined, hands behind his head, staring up through the tinted glass of the moonroof. He passed the hours by mentally searching Benjamin's apartment for a second time. He opened books and desk drawers, closets and file cabinets. He planned expeditions into uncharted regions. Dawn arrived, grey and forbidding, now a siege of torrential rain, now an avalanche of biting Rhone Valley wind. It never seemed to get properly light, and the headlights of the Peugeot stayed on all morning. At the German border, Gabriel felt a sudden fever when the guard seemed to take an extra moment scrutinizing the false Canadian passport that Pasner had given him in Rome. They sped across a plain of sodden Swabian farmland, keeping pace with the high-speed traffic on the Autobahn. In a town called Memmingen, Gabriel stopped for gas. Not far away was a shopping center with a small department store. He sent Chiara inside with a list. He fared better than he had in Cannes. 2 pairs of grey trousers, 2 button-down shirts, a black pullover sweater, a pair of black crepe-soled shoes, a quilted nylon raincoat. A second bag contained 2 flashlights and a pack of batteries, along with screwdrivers, pliers, and wrenches. Gabriel changed in the car while Chiara drove the final miles to Munich. It was mid-afternoon by the time they arrived. The sky was low and dark, and it was raining steadily. Operational weather, Shamron would have called it. A gift from the intelligence gods. Gabriel's head was throbbing with exhaustion, and his eyes felt as though there was sand beneath the lids. He tried to remember the last time he'd had a proper night's sleep. He looked at Chiara and saw that she was hanging on to the steering wheel as though it were the only thing keeping her upright. A hotel was out of the question. Chiara had an idea. Just beyond the old city center, near the Reichenbachplatz, stands a rather drab, flat-fronted stucco building. Above the glass double doors is a sign, Jüdisches Einkaufszentrum von München, Jewish Community Center of Munich. Chiara parked outside the front entrance and hurried inside. She returned 5 minutes later, drove around the corner, and parked opposite a side entrance. A girl was holding open the door. She was Chiara's age, heavy-hipped, with hair the color of a raven's wing. "How did you manage this?" Gabriel asked. "They called my father in Venice. He vouched for us." The interior of the center was modern and lit by harsh fluorescent light. They followed the girl up a staircase to the top floor, where they were shown into a small room with a bare linoleum floor and a pair of matching twin beds made up with beige spreads. To Gabriel, it seemed rather like a sick ward.
"We keep it for guests and emergencies," the girl said. "You're welcome to use it for a few hours. Through that door is a bathroom with a shower."
"I need to send a fax," Gabriel said.
"There's one downstairs. I'll take you."
Gabriel followed her to a small office near the main reception area.
"Do you have a copier?" "Of course. Right over."
Gabriel removed Sister Regina Carcassi's letter from his jacket pocket and made a photocopy. Then he scribbled a few words on a separate piece of paper and handed them all to the girl. Gabriel recited the number from memory, and she fed the pages into the fax machine.
"Vienna?" she asked.
Gabriel nodded. He heard the squelch as the fax machine made contact with Eli Lavon's office, then watched the pages slip through the feeder tray one by one. 2 minutes after the transmission was complete, the fax machine rang and spit out a single page with 2 hastily scrawled words. "Documents received." Gabriel recognized the handwriting as Lavon's.
"Do you need anything else?"
"Just a few hours of sleep."
"That I can't help you with."
She smiled at him for the first time.
"Can you find your way back upstairs?"
"No problem."
When he returned to the guest room, the curtains were tightly drawn. Chiara lay on one of the beds, knees pulled to her chest, already asleep. Gabriel undressed and slid beneath the blanket on the second bed, quietly settling onto the creaking bedsprings so as not to wake her. Then he closed his eyes and tumbled into a dreamless sleep. In Vienna, Eli Lavon stood over his fax machine, cigarette between his lips, squinting at the document pinched between the tips of his nicotine-stained fingers. He walked back to his office, where a man sat in the heavy afternoon shadows. Lavon waved the pages.
"Our hero and heroine have surfaced."
"Where are they?" asked Ari Shamron.
Lavon looked down at the fax and found the telephone number of the transmitting machine.
"It appears they're in Munich."
Shamron closed his eyes.
"Where in Munich?"
Lavon consulted the fax once more, and this time he was smiling when he looked up.
"It looks as though our boy has found his way back to the bosom of his people."
"And the document?"
"I'm afraid Italian is not one of my languages, but based on the first line, I'd say he found Sister Regina."
"Let me see that."
Lavon handed the fax pages to Shamron. He read the first line aloud.
Mi chiamo Regina Carcazzi.
Then looked up sharply at Levon.
Do you know anyone who speaks Italian?
I can find someone.
Now, Eli.
When Gabriel woke, the darkness was complete. He raised his wrist to his face and focused his gaze on the luminous dial of his watch. 10 o'clock. He reached down toward the floor and groped through his clothing until he found Sister Regina's letter. He breathed again. Chiara lay next to him. At some point, she had left her own bed and, like a small child, crawled into his. Her back was turned to him, and her hair lay across his pillow. When he touched her shoulder, she rolled over and faced him. Her eyes were damp.
What's wrong?
I was just thinking.
About what?
A long silence, broken by the blare of a car horn outside their window.
I used to pop into the church of San Zaccaria while you were working. I'd see you up there on your scaffolding, hidden behind your shroud. Sometimes I'd peer around the edge and see you staring at the face of the Virgin.
Obviously I'm going to have to get a bigger shroud.
It's her, isn't it? When you look at the Virgin, you see the face of your wife. You see her scars.
When Gabriel made no response, Chiara propped her head on her elbow and studied his face, running her forefinger down the length of his nose as though it was sculpture.
I feel so sorry for you.
I have no one to blame but myself. I was a fool to bring her into the field.
That's why I feel sorry for you. If you could blame someone else, it might be easier.
She laid her head on his chest and was silent for a moment.
God, but I hate this place. Munich, the place where it all started. Did you know Hitler had a headquarters a few streets over?
I know.
I used to think everything had changed for the better. 6 months ago, someone put a coffin outside my father's synagogue. There was a swastika on the lid. Inside was a note. This coffin is for the Jews of Venice, the ones we didn't get the first time.
It's not real, Gabriel said. At least, the threat isn't real.
It frightened the old ones. You see, they remember when it was real.
She lifted her hand to her face and pushed a tear from her cheek.
Do you really think Benny had something else?
I'd stake my life on it.
What else do we need? A bishop from the Vatican sat down with Martin Luther in 1942 and gave his blessing to the murder of millions. 60 years later, Crux Vera killed your friend and many more to keep it a secret.
I don't want Crux Vera to succeed. I want to expose the secret, and I need more than Sister Regina's letter in order to do that.
Do you know what this will do to the Vatican?
I'm afraid that's not my concern.
You'll destroy it, she said. Then you'll go back to the Church of San Zaccaria and finish restoring your Bellini. You're a man of contradictions, aren't you?
So I've been told.
She lifted her head, resting her chin on his breastbone, and stared into his eyes. Her hair spilled over his cheeks.
Why do they hate us, Gabriel? What did we ever do to them?
The Peugeot was where they had left it, parked at the side entrance of the community center, glistening beneath a yellow street lamp. Gabriel drove carefully through the wet streets. He skirted the city center on the Thomas Wiener Ring, a broad boulevard encircling the heart of old Munich, then headed toward Schwabing on the Ludwigstrasse. At the entrance of a U-Bahn station, he saw a stack of blue flyers beneath the weight of a red brick. Chiara darted out, scooped up the papers, and brought them back to the car. Gabriel twice drove past Adalbertstrasse 68 before deciding it was safe to proceed. He parked around the corner, on the Bahrerstrasse, and killed the engine. A streetcar rattled past, empty but for a single old woman gazing hopelessly through the fogged glass. As they walked toward the entrance of the apartment house, Gabriel thought of his first conversation with Detective Axel Weiss. The tenants are very casual about who they let in. If someone presses the intercom and says, "Advertisements," they're routinely buzzed in. Gabriel hesitated, then simultaneously pushed 2 buttons. A few seconds later, a sleepy voice answered,
"Yeah?"
Gabriel murmured the password. The buzzer howled, and the door unlocked. They stepped inside, and the door closed automatically behind them. Gabriel opened and closed it a second time, for the benefit of anyone who might be listening. Then he placed the stack of flyers on the ground and crossed the foyer to the staircase, quickly, in case the old caretaker was still awake. They crept quietly up the stairs to the second-floor landing. The door to Benjamin's apartment was still marked with crime scene tape, and an official-looking note on the door declared that it was off-limits. The makeshift memorial, the flowers, the notes of condolence, had been cleared away. Chiara crouched and went to work on the lock with a slender metal tool. Gabriel turned his back to her and watched the stairwell. 30 seconds later he heard the lock give way, and Chiara pushed open the door. They ducked beneath the crime scene tape and went inside. Gabriel closed the door and switched on his flashlight. "Work quickly," he said. "Don't worry about making a mess." He led her into the large room overlooking the street, the room Benjamin had used as his office. The beam of Chiara's flashlight fell across the neo-Nazi graffiti on the wall. "My God," she whispered. "You start at that end," Gabriel said. "We'll search each room together, then we'll move to the next." They worked silently but efficiently. Gabriel tore the desk to pieces, while Chiara pulled every book from its shelf and thumbed through the pages. Nothing. Next, Gabriel went to work on the furniture, removing slipcovers, pulling apart cushions. Nothing. He turned over the coffee table and unscrewed the legs to check for hollow compartments. Nothing. Together they turned over the rug and searched for a slit where documents might be concealed. Nothing. Gabriel got down on all fours and patiently checked every floorboard to see if one of them had been loosened. Chiara removed the covers from the heating vents. Hell! At one end of the room was a doorway leading to a small antechamber. Inside, Benjamin had stored more books. Gabriel and Chiara searched the room together and found nothing. Closing the door on the way out, Gabriel detected a faint sound, something unfamiliar, not the squeak of a dry hinge, but a rustle of some sort. He put his hand on the knob, then opened and closed the door several times in quick succession. Open, close, open, close, open. The door was hollow, and it sounded as if there was something inside. He turned to Chiara. "Hand me that screw." He knelt down and loosened the screws holding the latch to the door. When he finished, he separated the latch. Attached to one of them was a line of nylon filament, hanging into the interior of the door. Gabriel gently tugged on the filament, and up came a clear plastic bag with a Ziploc enclosure. Inside was a tightly folded batch of papers. "My God," Chiara said, "I can't believe you actually found it." Gabriel pried open the Ziploc bag, then carefully removed the papers and unfolded them by the illumination of Chiara's flashlight. He closed his eyes, swore softly, and held the papers up for Chiara to see. It was a copy of Sister Regina's letter. Gabriel got slowly to his feet. It had taken more than an hour to find something they already had. How much longer would it take to find what they needed? He drew a deep breath and turned around. It was then that he saw the shadow of a figure standing in the center of the room amid the clutter. He reached into his pocket, wrapped his fingers around the butt of the Beretta, and quickly drew it out. As his arm swung up to the firing position, Chiara illuminated the target with the beam of her flashlight. Fortunately, Gabriel managed to prevent his forefinger from pulling the trigger, because standing 10 feet in front of him, with her hands shading her eyes, was an old woman wrapped in a pink bathrobe. There was a pathological neatness about Frau Ratzinger's tiny flat that Gabriel recognized at once. The kitchen was spotless and sterile, the dishes in her little china cabinet fastidiously placed. The knick-knacks on the coffee table in her sitting room looked as though they had been arranged and rearranged by an inmate in an asylum, which, in many respects, thought Gabriel, she was. "Where were you?" he asked carefully in a voice he might have used for a small child.
"First, Dachau, then Ravensbrück, and finally Riga."
She paused for a moment.
"My parents were murdered at Riga. They were shot by the Einsatzgruppen, the roving SS death squads, and buried, along with 27,000 others, in a trench dug by Russian prisoners of war.
Then she rolled up her sleeve to show Gabriel her number, like the number that Gabriel's mother had tried so desperately to conceal. Even in the fierce summer heat of the Jezreel Valley, she would wear a long-sleeved blouse, rather than allow a stranger to see her tattoo, her mark of shame, she called it, her emblem of Jewish weakness.
"Benjamin was afraid he would be killed," she said. "They used to call him at all hours, and say the most horrible things on his telephone. They used to stand outside the building at night to frighten him. He told me that if anything ever happened to him, men would come. Men from Israel."
She opened the drawer of her china cabinet and pulled out a white linen tablecloth. With Chiara's help, she unfolded it. Hidden inside was a legal-size envelope, the edges and flap sealed with heavy plastic packing tape.
"This is what you were looking for, yes?"
She held it up for Gabriel to see.
"The first time I saw you, I thought you might be the one, but I didn't feel I could trust you. There were many strange things taking place in that apartment. Men coming in the middle of the night, policemen carting off Benjamin's belongings. I was afraid. As you might imagine, I still do not trust German men in uniform."
Her melancholy eyes settled on Gabriel's face.
"You're not his brother, are you?"
"No, I'm not, Frau Ratzinger."
"I didn't think so. That's why I gave you the eyeglasses. If you were the man Benjamin was talking about, I knew you would follow the clues, and that eventually you would find your way back to me. I had to be certain you were the right man. Are you the right man, Herr Landau?"
"I'm not Herr Landau, but I am the right man."
"Your German is very good," she said. "You are from Israel, aren't you?"
"I grew up in the Jezreel Valley," Gabriel said, switching to Hebrew without warning. "Benjamin was the closest thing to a brother I ever had. I'm the man he would have wanted to see what's inside that envelope."
"Then I believe this belongs to you,"
she responded in the same language.
"Finish your friend's work. But whatever you do, don't come back here again. It's not safe for you here."
Then she carefully placed the envelope in Gabriel's hands and touched his face.
"Go,"
she said. Part 4. A Synagogue by the River. Chapter 25. Vatican City. Benedetto Fowa presented himself for work at the four-story office building near the entrance of St. Peter's Square at the thoroughly reasonable Roman hour of 10:30. In a city filled with beautifully dressed men, Fowa was clearly an exception. His trousers had long ago lost their crease, the toes of his black leather shoes were scuffed, and the pockets of his sport jacket had been misshapen by his habit of filling them with notepads, tape recorders, and batches of folded papers. The Vatican correspondent for La Repubblica, Fowa did not trust a man who couldn't carry his possessions in his pockets. He picked his way through a pack of tourists, queued up outside the souvenir shops on the ground floor, and tried to enter the foyer. A blue-uniformed guard blocked his path. Fowa sighed heavily and rummaged through his pockets until he found his press credentials. It was a wholly unnecessary ritual, for Benedetto Fowa was the dean of the Vaticanisti, and his face was as well known to the press office security staff as the one belonging to the Austrian bully boy who ran the place. Forcing him to show his badge was just another form of subtle punishment, like banning him from the Pope's airplane for next month's papal visit to Argentina and Chile. Fowa had been a naughty boy. Fowa was on probation. He'd been placed on the rack and offered a chance to repent. One more misstep, and they'd tie him to the stake and light a match. The Sala Stampa della Santa Sede, otherwise known as the Vatican Press Office, was an island of modernity in a Renaissance sea. Fowa passed through a set of automatic glass doors, then crossed the floor of polished black marble to his cubicle in the press room. The Vatican inflicted a vow of poverty on those it deemed worthy of permanent credentials. Foa's office consisted of a tiny formica desk with a telephone and a fax machine that was forever breaking down at the worst possible time. His neighbor was a Rubenesque blonde from Inside the Vatican magazine called Giovanna. She thought him a heretic and refused his repeated invitations to lunch. He sat heavily in his chair. A copy of L'Osservatore Romano lay on his desk, next to a stack of clippings from the Vatican News Service. The Vatican's version of Pravda and Tass. With a heavy heart, Foer began to read, like a Kremlinologist looking for hidden meaning in an announcement that a certain member of the Politburo was suffering from a heavy chest cold. It was the usual drivel. Foer pushed aside the papers and began the long deliberation about where to have lunch. He looked at Giovanna. Perhaps this would be the day her stoicism crumbled. He squeezed his way inside her cubicle. She was hunched over a bollettino, an official press release. When Foer peered over her shoulder, she covered it with her forearm, like a schoolgirl hiding a test paper from the boy at the next desk. "What is it, Giovanna?"
"They just released it. Go get your own and see for yourself."
She shoved him into the hall. The touch of her hand on Foer's hip lingered as he made his way toward the front of the room, where a fierce-looking nun sat behind a wooden desk. She bore an uncomfortable resemblance to a teacher who used to beat him with a stick. She handed him a pair of bollettini, joylessly, like a camp guard doling out punishment rations. Just to annoy her, Foer read them standing in front of the desk. The first dealt with a staff appointment at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Hardly anything the readers of La Repubblica cared about. Foer would leave that one for Giovanna and her cohorts at the Catholic News Service. The second was far more interesting. It was issued in the form of an amendment to the Holy Father's schedule on Friday. He had cancelled an audience with a delegation from the Philippines, and instead would pay a brief visit to the Great Synagogue of Rome to address the congregation. Foer looked up and frowned. A trip to the synagogue, announced 2 days before the fact? Impossible. An event like that should have been on the papal schedule weeks ago. It didn't take an experienced Vatican hand to know something was up. Foer peered down a marble-floored corridor. At the end was an open door, giving on to a pompous office. Seated behind a polished desk was a forbidding figure named Rudolf Gertz, the former Austrian television journalist, who was now the head of the Vatican press office. It was against the rules to set foot in the corridor without permission. Foer decided on a suicide run. When the nun wasn't looking, he leapt down the hall like a springbok. A few steps from Gertz's door, a burly priest seized Foer by his coat collar and lifted him off the floor. Foer managed to hold up the bollettino.
"What do you think you're playing at, Rudolf? Do you take us for idiots? How dare you drop this on us with 2 days' notice? We should have been briefed. Why is he going? What's he going to say?"
Gertz looked up calmly. He had a skier's tan and was groomed for the evening news. Foer hung there helplessly, awaiting an answer he knew would never come, for somewhere during his journey from Vienna to the Vatican, Rudolf Gertz seemed to have lost the ability to speak.
"You don't know why he's going to the synagogue, do you, Rudolf? The Pope is keeping secrets from the press office. Something is up, and I'm going to find out what it is."
Gertz raised an eyebrow. "I wish you the best of luck." The burly priest took it as a signal to frog march Foer back to the press room and deposit him at his cubicle. Foer shoved his things into his coat pockets and headed downstairs. He walked toward the river along the Via della Conciliazione, the bollettino still crumpled in his fist. Foer knew it was a signal of cataclysmic events to come. He just didn't know what they were. Against all better judgment, he had allowed himself to be used in a game as old as time itself, a Vatican intrigue, pitting one wing of the Curia against the other. He suspected that the surprise announcement of a visit to the Great Synagogue of Rome was the culmination of that game. He was furious that he'd been blindsided like everyone else. He'd made a deal. The deal, in the opinion of Benedetto Foer, had been broken. He stopped in the piazza, just outside the ramparts of the Castel Sant'Angelo. He needed to make a telephone call, a call that couldn't be made from his desk in the Sala Stampa. From a public telephone, he dialed a number for an extension inside the Apostolic Palace. It was the private number of a man very close to the Holy Father.
He answered as though he were expecting Foa's call.
"We had an agreement, Luigi,"
Foa said without preamble.
"You broke that agreement."
"Calm down, Benedetto. Don't hurl accusations that you'll regret later.
I agreed to play your little game about the Holy Father's childhood in exchange for something special.
Trust me, Benedetto, something very special will be coming your way sooner than you think.
I'm about to be permanently banned from the Sala Stampa because I helped you. The least you could have done is warn me that this trip to the synagogue was coming."
"I couldn't do that, for reasons that will be abundantly clear to you in the coming days. As for your problems at the Sala Stampa, this, too, shall pass."
"Why is he going to the synagogue?"
"You'll have to wait until Friday, like everyone else."
"You're a bastard, Luigi.
Please try to remember you're talking to a priest."
"You're not a priest. You're a cutthroat in a clerical suit."
"Flattery will get you nowhere, Benedetto. I'm sorry, but the Holy Father would like a word." The line went dead. Foa slammed down the receiver and headed wearily back to the press office. A short distance away, in a barricaded diplomatic compound at the end of a tree-lined cul-de-sac called the Via Micle Mercati, Aaron Shiloh, Israel's ambassador to the Holy See, was seated behind his desk, leafing his way through a batch of morning correspondence from the Foreign Ministry in Tel Aviv. A compact woman with short, dark hair knocked on the door jamb and entered the room without waiting for permission. Yael Ravona, Ambassador Shiloh's secretary, dropped a single sheet of paper on his desk. It was a bulletin from the Vatican News Service. "This just came over the wire." The ambassador read it quickly, then looked up. "The synagogue? Why didn't they tell us something like this was coming? It makes no sense." "Judging from the tone of that dispatch, the press office and VNS were caught off guard." "Put in a call to the Secretariat of State. Tell them I'd like to speak with Cardinal Brindisi."
"Yes, Ambassador."
Yael Ravona walked out. The ambassador picked up his telephone and dialed the number in Tel Aviv. A moment later he said quietly, "I need to speak to Shamron." At that same moment, Carlo Casagrande was seated in the back of his Vatican staff car, speeding along the winding S4 motorway through the mountains northeast of Rome. The reason for this unscheduled journey lay in the locked attaché case resting on the seat next to him. It was a report, delivered to him earlier that morning, by the agent he had assigned to investigate the childhood of the Holy Father. The agent had been forced to resort to a black bag operation, a break-in at the apartment of Benedetto Foa. A hurried search of Foa's files had produced his notes on the matter. A summary of those notes was contained in the report. The Villa Galatina appeared, perched on its own mountain, glowering at the valley below. Casagrande glimpsed one of Roberto Pucci's guards, high among the battlements, a rifle slung over his shoulder. The front gate was open. A tan-suited security man glanced at the SCV license plates and waved the car onto the property. Roberto Pucci greeted Casagrande in the entrance hall. He was dressed in riding breeches and knee-length leather boots, and smelled of gunsmoke. Obviously he had spent the morning shooting. Don Pucci often said that the only thing he loved more than his collection of guns was making money. And the Holy Mother Church, of course. The financier escorted Casagrande down a long, gloomy gallery into a cavernous great room overlooking the garden. Cardinal Marco Brindisi was already there, a thin figure perched on the edge of a chair in front of the fire, a teacup balanced precariously on his cassocked thigh. Light reflected off the lenses of the cardinal's small, round spectacles, turning them to white discs that obscured his eyes. Casagrande dropped to one knee and kissed the proffered ring. Brindisi extended the first two fingers of his right hand and solemnly offered his blessing. The cardinal, thought Casagrande, had exquisite hands. Casagrande sat down, worked the combination locks on his attaché, and lifted the lid. Brindisi held out his hand and accepted a single sheet of typescript on Vatican Security Office letterhead, then looked down and began to read. Casagrande folded his hands across his lap and waited patiently.
Roberto Pucci paced the floor, a restless hunter looking for a target of opportunity. A moment later, Cardinal Brindisi stood and took a few teetering steps toward the fireplace. He dropped the report on the flames and watched it curl and disintegrate, then turned and faced Casagrande and Pucci, his eyes hidden behind the two white disks of light. Brindisi's uomini di fiducia, his men of trust, awaited the verdict, though for Casagrande there was little suspense, because he knew the course that Brindisi would choose. Brindisi's church was in mortal danger. Drastic measures were in order. Roberto Pucci was a perpetual target of the Italian intelligence services, and it had been many days since the Villa Galatina had been swept for listening devices. Before Cardinal Brindisi could pronounce his death sentence, Casagrande raised his finger to his lips and his eyes to the ceiling. Despite a cold rain, they walked in Don Pucci's garden, umbrellas overhead, like mourners following a horse-drawn coffin. The hem of the cardinal's cassock quickly became soaked. To Casagrande, it seemed they were wading shoulder to shoulder in blood.
"Pope Accidental is playing a very dangerous game," Cardinal Brindisi said. "His initiative to throw open the archives is simply a ploy to give him cover to reveal things he already knows. It is an act of unbelievable recklessness. I believe it's quite possible that the Holy Father is delusional or mentally unbalanced in some way. We have a duty, indeed, a divine mandate, to remove him."
Roberto Pucci cleared his throat.
"Removing him and killing him are two different things, Eminence."
"Not really, Don Pucci. The conclave made him an absolute monarch. We cannot simply ask the king to step aside. Only death can end this papacy."
Casagrande looked up at the row of cypress trees, swaying in the gusty wind.
"Kill the Pope? Insanity."
He turned his gaze from the trees and looked at Brindisi. The cardinal was studying him intently. The pinched face, the round spectacles, it was like being appraised by Pius XII himself. Brindisi looked away.
"Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest?
Do you know who spoke those words, Carlo?"
"King Henry II, if I'm not mistaken, and the meddlesome priest he was referring to was Thomas a Becket. Not long after he uttered those words, four of his knights stormed into the cathedral at Canterbury and cut Thomas down with their swords."
"Very impressive," said the cardinal. "Pope Accidental and St. Thomas have much in common. Thomas was a vain, ostentatious man who did much to bring about his own demise. The same can surely be said of the Holy Father. He has no right to bypass the Curia and launch this initiative on his own. And for his sins and his vanity, he must suffer the fate of Thomas. Send forth your knights, Carlo. Cut him down."
"If the Holy Father dies a violent death, he will become a martyr, just like St. Thomas."
"So much the better. If his death is choreographed properly, this whole sordid affair might end in a way that suits our purposes quite nicely."
"How so, Eminence?"
"Can you imagine the wrath that will rain down on the heads of the Jews if the Holy Father is killed in a synagogue? Surely an assassin with the skills of your friend can carry off something like that. Once he is gone, we will build a case against our papal assassin, the Israeli who settled in our midst and restored our precious works of art while he waited for his chance to murder the Holy Father. It is a remarkable story, Carlo. One the world's media will find difficult to resist."
"If not difficult to believe, Eminence."
"Not if you do your job correctly."
A silence hung over them, broken only by the crunch of their footsteps on the gravel pathway. Casagrande could not feel his feet touching the earth. He felt he was floating, viewing the scene from above. The ancient abbey, the labyrinth gardens, three men, the Holy Trinity of Crux Vera, calmly deliberating whether to murder a pope. He squeezed the handle of his umbrella assessing whether it was real or merely an object in a dream. He wished it could carry him away, transport him to another time, a time before his faith and his obsession for revenge had caused him to behave with the same cruelty and depravity as his enemies. He saw Angelina, seated on a blanket in the shade of a stone pine in the Villa Borghese. He bent to kiss her, expecting to find the taste of strawberries on her lips, but instead he tasted blood. He heard a voice. In his memory, it was Angelina, telling him she wanted to spend the summer holiday in the mountains of the north. In reality, it was Cardinal Brindisi, holding forth on why the murder of a pope would serve the interests of both the church and Crux Vera. How easily the cardinal speaks of murder, thought Casagrande. And then he saw it all clearly. A church in turmoil. A time for proven leadership. After the Holy Father's death, Brindisi would seize what the last conclave had denied him. Casagrande marshaled his forces and proceeded carefully.
If I may approach the issue from an operational standpoint, Eminence, killing a pope is not something that can be done on the spur of the moment. It takes months, perhaps years, to plan something like this.
He paused, waiting for Brindisi to interrupt, but the cardinal kept walking, a man on a journey with a great distance still to go. Casagrande carried on. Once the Holy Father leaves the territory of the Vatican, he will be under the protection of Italian police and security services. At the moment, they are on war footing because of a spurious papal assassin. There will be a wall around the Holy Father that will be impossible to penetrate.
What you say is true, Carlo, but there are two important factors weighing heavily in our favor. You work for the Vatican Security Office. You have the ability to get a man close to the Holy Father whenever you please.
And the second?
The man you will get close to the Holy Father is the leopard.
I doubt even the leopard would accept an assignment like the one you're proposing, Eminence.
Offer him money. That's what creatures like him respond to.
Casagrande felt as though he were hurling himself against the walls of the old abbey. He decided to make one final assault.
When I came to the Vatican from the Carabinieri, I swore a sacred oath to protect the Pope. Now you are asking me to break that oath, Eminence. You also swore a sacred oath to Crux Vera, and to me personally, an oath that binds you to absolute obedience.
Casagrande stopped walking and turned to face the cardinal. His spectacles were dotted with rain.
I had hopes of seeing my wife and daughter once again in the kingdom of heaven, Eminence. Surely the only thing that awaits the man who carries out this deed is damnation. You need not worry about confronting the fires of hell, Carlo. I will grant you absolution.
Do you really have such power? The power to cleanse the soul of a man who murders a pope?
Of course I do,
snapped Brindisi, as if he found the question blasphemous. Then his demeanor and his tone softened.
You're tired, Carlo. This affair has been long and difficult for all of us. But there is a way out, and soon it will be over.
At what cost, Eminence? To us? To the church?
He wants to destroy the church. I want to save it. Who do you stand with?
After a moment's hesitation, Casagrande said, I stand with you, Eminence, and the Holy Mother Church.
As I knew you would.
I have just one question. Do you intend to accompany the Holy Father to the synagogue? I wouldn't want you to be anywhere near the Holy Father when this terrible deed is done.
As I told the Holy Father when he asked me the same question, I intend to have a case of the flu on Friday that will not permit me to be at his side.
Casagrande seized the cardinal's hand and feverishly kissed his ring. The prelate extended his long fingers and made the sign of the cross over Casagrande's forehead. There was no love in his eyes, only coldness and a fierce determination. From Casagrande's vantage point, it seemed he was anointing a dead man. Cardinal Brindisi departed for Rome first. Casagrande and Roberto Pucci remained behind in the garden.
It doesn't take a terribly perceptive man to see that your heart is not in this, Carlo.
Only a madman would relish the opportunity to murder a pope.
What do you intend to do?
Casagrande moved some gravel around with the toe of his shoe, then looked up at the cypress trees bending in the wind. He knew he was about to embark on a course that would ultimately lead to his own destruction.
I'm going to Zurich, Casagrande said. I'm going to hire an assassin.
Chapter 26. Vienna. Eli Lavon's office looked like the command bunker of an army in fighting retreat. Open files lay scattered across the tabletops, and a map hung crookedly on the wall. There were ashtrays overflowing with half-smoked cigarettes, and a waste paper basket filled with half-eaten remnants of a dismal carry-out meal. A cup of cold coffee was balanced precariously atop a stack of books. A silent television flickered, unnoticed, in the corner. Lavon had clearly been expecting them. He had flung open the door before Gabriel had even pressed the buzzer, and hauled them inside like guests late for a dinner party in their honor. He had waved the facsimile of Sister Regina's letter, and peppered Gabriel with questions as he led him down the corridor.
Where did you find this? What were you doing back in Munich? Do you know the trouble you've caused? Half the office is looking for you. My God, Gabriel, but you gave us a scare.
Shamron had said nothing. Shamron had survived enough disasters to realize that in due time he would learn everything he needed to know. As Lavon berated Gabriel, the old man paced the floorboards before the window overlooking the courtyard. His reflection was visible in the bulletproof glass. To Gabriel, the mirror image seemed like another version of Shamron, younger and more sure-footed, Shamron the Invincible. Gabriel sat heavily upon Lavon's couch. With Chiara at his side, he produced the envelope Frau Ratzinger had given him in Munich and laid it on the file-strewn coffee table. Lavon shoved a pair of reading glasses onto his face and carefully removed the contents, a photocopy of 2 pages of single-spaced typescript. He looked down and began to read. After a moment, his face drained of color and the papers were trembling between his fingertips. He glanced up at Gabriel and whispered,
"Unbelievable."
Lavon held it up for Shamron.
"I think you'd better take a look at this, boss."
Shamron paused long enough to scan the letterhead, then resumed his journey.
"Read it to me, Eli," he said. "In German, please. I want to hear it in German."
Reich Ministry for Foreign Affairs. 2. SS Obersturmbahnführer Adolf Eichmann, RSH, IV B4. From Unterstaatssekretär Martin Luther, Abteilung Deutschland, regarding the policy of the Holy See concerning Jewish matters. Berlin, March 30th, 1942. 64-34-25/1. My meeting with His Grace Bishop Sebastiano Lorenzi at the Convent of the Sacred Heart in northern Italy was an unqualified success. As you know, Bishop Lorenzi is the leading expert on the relations between Germany and the Holy See inside the Vatican Secretariat of State. He is also a member of the Orthodox Catholic Society, known as Crux Vera, which has been very supportive of National Socialism from the beginning. Bishop Lorenzi is very close to the Holy Father and speaks with him on a daily basis. They attended the Gregorian College together, and the bishop was a leading player during the negotiations over the Concordat reached between the Reich and the Holy See in 1933. I have worked closely with Bishop Lorenzi for some time. It is my opinion that he agrees wholeheartedly with our policy toward the Jews, though for obvious reasons he cannot say so. He couches his positions regarding the Jews in theological terms, but in candid moments he betrays his beliefs
that they are a social and economic menace, as well as heretics and mortal enemies of the Church.
During our meeting, which was held in the pleasant surroundings of a convent situated on the shores of Lake Garda, we discussed many aspects of our Jewish policy and why it must go forward, unencumbered. Bishop Lorenzi seemed most impressed by my suggestion that a failure to deal with the Jews in a timely and thorough manner could lead to the creation of a Jewish state in the Holy Land. To buttress my arguments, I quoted heavily from your 1938 memorandum on that topic, in which you argued that a Jewish state in Palestine would only increase the power of world Jewry in law and international relations, because a miniature state would permit the Jew to send ambassadors and delegates around the world to promote his lust for domination. In that respect, the Jew would be placed on equal footing with political Catholicism, something Bishop Lorenzi is eager to prevent at all costs. Nor does he, or the Holy Father, wish to see Jews controlling the sacred Christian sites of the Holy Land. I made clear our position that the papal protest of the roundups and deportations would be a clear violation of the Concordat. I also vigorously pressed my position that a papal protest would have profound and disastrous effects on our Jewish policy. Lorenzi, more than others, realizes the power possessed by the Holy See in this matter, and he is committed to making certain the Pope does not speak. With the help of Bishop Lorenzi, I believe the Holy Father will be able to weather the storm of pressure put on him by our enemies and will maintain his position of strict neutrality. In my opinion, our position with the Vatican is secure, and we can expect no meaningful resistance to our Jewish policies from the Holy See or from Roman Catholics under Reich control. Shamron had stopped pacing and seemed to be studying his face in the glass. He took a long time lighting his next cigarette. Gabriel could see he was thinking four moves ahead.
"It's been some time since we last spoke," he said. "Before we go any further, I think you need to explain how you came by these documents."
As Gabriel began his account, Shamron resumed his private journey before the window. Gabriel told him about his meeting in London with Peter Malone, and how, in France, the following morning, he learned of Malone's murder. He told him of his meeting with Inspector Alessio Rossi at the Pensione Abruzzi, and the gun battle that left Rossi and four other men dead. He told him of his decision to hijack the motor yacht to continue his investigation rather than return to Israel.
"But you're forgetting something," Shamron interjected.
He spoke with uncharacteristic gentleness, as though he were addressing small children.
"I saw Shimon Pasner's field report. According to Pasner, you were followed as you left the safe flat. A pair of men in a beige Lancia sedan. The second team dealt with the Lancia, and you then proceeded without incident to the departure point on the beach. Is that correct?"
"I never saw the surveillance. I only heard what Pasner told me. The people in the Lancia might have been watching us, or they might have been a couple of ordinary Romans on their way to dinner who got the surprise of their life."
"They might have been, but I doubt it. You see, a short time later, a beige Lancia was discovered near the train station. Behind the wheel was a Palestinian named Marwan Aziz, a man known to be an agent of PLO intelligence. He'd been shot three times and was quite dead. And by the way, the Lancia's left rear bumper was damaged. Marwan Aziz was one of the men who was following you. I wonder where the second man went. I wonder whether he was the one who killed Aziz. But I digress. Please, continue."
Intrigued by Shamron's revelations, Gabriel pressed forward. The boat journey to Cannes, the meeting with Antonella Huber, at which she surrendered the letter written by her mother, the former sister, Regina Carcassi,
the dying man he had left behind in the field outside Saint-Césaire, the midnight search of Benjamin's flat, and the near-fatal confrontation with his caretaker, Frau Ratzinger. Shamron ceased his pacing only once, when Gabriel admitted that he had actually threatened Carlo Casagrande. An understandable reaction, said the look on the old man's creased face, but hardly the behavior one would expect from an agent of Gabriel's training and experience.
Which brings us to the obvious next question, Shamron said. Is the document real, or is it the Vatican equivalent of the Hitler diaries?
Levon held it up.
Do you see these markings? They are consistent with documents from the KGB archives. If I had to guess, the Russians came across this while they were cleaning out their archives after the collapse of the Empire. Somehow it reached Benjamin's hands.
But is it a hoax?
Taken in isolation, it might be easy to dismiss as a clever forgery concocted by the KGB in order to discredit the Catholic Church. After all, they were at each other's throats throughout much of the century, especially during the reign of Wojtyla and the crisis in Poland.
Gabriel leaned forward, elbows on his knees. But if it's read in concert with Sister Regina's letter and all the other things I've learned?
Then it's probably the single most damning document I've ever seen. A senior Vatican official discussing genocide with Martin Luther over dinner? The Covenant at the Garda? It's no wonder people are dying because of this. If this is made public, it will be the equivalent of a nuclear bomb going off in St. Peter's Square.
Can you authenticate it?
I have a few contacts inside the old KGB. So does the quiet little man standing in the window over there. It's not something he likes to talk about, but he and his friends from Dzerzhinsky Square did quite a lot of business together over the years. I bet he could get to the bottom of this in a couple of days, if he set his mind to it.
Shamron looked at Levon as if to say it would take him no more than an afternoon. Then what would we do with the information? Asked Gabriel. Leak it to the New York Times? A Nazi memorandum via the KGB and Israeli intelligence? The church would deny that the meeting ever took place and attack the messenger. Very few people would believe us. It would also poison relations between Israel and the Vatican. Everything John Paul II did to repair relations between Catholics and Jews would go up in flames. Frustration showed on Levon's face.
The conduct of Pope Pius and the Vatican during the war is a matter of state concern for the government of Israel. There are those in the church who wish to declare Pius XII a saint. It is the policy of the Israeli government that no canonization should take place until all relevant documents in the secret archives have been released and examined. This material should be turned over to the foreign ministry in Tel Aviv and acted upon.
It should, Elijah, said Shamron, but I'm afraid Gabriel speaks the truth. That document is too dangerous to make public. What do you think the Vatican is going to say? Oh dear, how could this have happened? We're terribly sorry. No, that's not how they'll react. They'll attack us, and it will blow up in our faces. Our relations with the Vatican are tenuous at best. There are many members of the Secretariat of State who would use any excuse, including our involvement in this affair, to sever them. For anything good to come of this, it has to be handled delicately and quietly, from the inside. By you? Forgive me, boss, but the words delicate and quiet don't leap into my mind when I think about you. Lev gave you and Gabriel permission to investigate Penny's death. Not cause a firestorm in our relations with the Holy See? You should turn the material over to the foreign ministry and go back to Tiberias. Under normal circumstances, I might take your advice, but I'm afraid the situation has changed.
What are you talking about, boss?
The phone call I took earlier this morning was from Aaron Shiloh, our ambassador to the Holy See. It seems there's been an unexpected addition
to the Holy Father's schedule. Which brings us back to the gentlemen who followed you when you left the safe flat in Rome.
Shamron sat down opposite Gabriel and placed a photograph on the table.
This photograph was taken in Bucharest 15 years ago. Recognize him?
Gabriel nodded. The man in the photograph was the assassin and terrorist for hire known only as the Leopard. Shamron laid a second photograph on the table, next to the first.
This photograph was taken by Mordecai in London, minutes after the murder of Peter Malone. Research ran the photographs through the face recognition software. They're the same men. Peter Malone was murdered by the Leopard.
And Benny? Asked Gabriel.
If they hired the Leopard to kill Malone, it's quite possible they hired him to kill Benny, but we may never know for certain.
Obviously you have a theory about the dead Palestinian in Rome.
I do, Shamron said. We know the Leopard had a long and fruitful association with Palestinian terror groups. The operation on Cyprus was testament to that. We also know that he'd reached a deal with Abu Jihad to carry out additional acts of terror against Israeli citizens. Fortunately, you cut short Abu Jihad's illustrious career, and the Leopard's operations never came to pass.
You think the Leopard's renewed his relationship with the Palestinians in order to find me?
I'm afraid it does make a certain amount of sense. Crux vera wants you dead, and so do many people within the Palestinian movement. It's quite possible that the Leopard was the second man in that Lancia, and that he was the one who killed Marwan Aziz.
Gabriel picked up the photographs and studied them carefully, as if they were a pair of canvases, one that had been authenticated, and one that was thought to have been painted by the same artist. It was impossible to tell with the naked eye, but he had learned long ago that the face recognition software in research rarely made a mistake. Then he closed his eyes and saw different faces, the faces of the dead, Felici, Manzini, Carcassi, Benny, Rossi. Lastly, he saw a man in a white cassock, entering a synagogue by the river in Rome, a cassock stained with blood. He opened his eyes and looked at Shamron.
We need to get the message to the Pope that his life may be in grave danger.
Shamron folded his arms and lowered his chin to his chest.
And how shall we do that? Call Rome in formation and ask for the Pope's private number? Everything goes through channels, and the Curia is famous for its slowness. If our ambassador goes through the Secretariat of State, it could take weeks to arrange an audience with the Pope. If I try to get him through the Vatican Security Office, we'll run straight into Carlo Casagrande and his Crux Vera goons. We need to find someone who can take us up the back staircase of the Apostolic Palace to see the Pope privately, and we need to do it before Friday. Otherwise, His Holiness might never leave the great synagogue of Rome alive. And that's the last thing we need.
A long silence hung over the room. It was broken by Gabriel.
I know someone who can get us in to see the Pope, he said calmly. But you have to get me back into Venice.
This book is continued on Disc 8.